Hey everybody, John DeChristopher here, and welcome to another episode of Live from My Drum Room. My guest today is my old friend Zach Alford, and in this episode, Zach and I talk about how we met 35 years ago in 1989, and how his career took off in 1990 playing with the B-52s, and Bruce Springsteen, and David Bowie, and Gwen Stefani, and recording with Billy Joel, and currently playing with the Psychedelic Furs, and everything in between. So come along for the ride. I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. I'll see you on the other side. But please welcome my good friend and tremendous drummer, Zach Alford.
Oh, hey, John. Hey.
Welcome, Zach. Thanks for being here. Yeah, 35 years. That's how, when I first started at Zildjian, I met you not long after that. And
right. That's what I thought. I thought we were both kind of early in our, you know, being on the scene.
Yeah, man. Well, you were definitely on the scene. I mean, you were already making, you know, a lot of moves at that point. And as we said, our mutual friend, Scott Braun, by my recollection, Scott, who was working at Manny's, called me, and I knew him from years before, and said, you got to check out this drummer, Zach Alford. And he's in this band Body Bag. And then you and I got on the phone, and you sent me a demo of the band, and it all started. So a year later, you get the gig with the B-52s when they're like, they'd come back with Cosmic Thing, and they were like as big as they ever were, or probably bigger, really.
Much bigger. They went from like being almost, I mean, we didn't even call it indie at the time. They were, you could say they were like cult bowlings. But
like a college,
Rock Lobster was a hit.
Yeah.
You know, Private Idaho. They weren't mainstream hits, but they were hits in the post-punk sort of new wave scene.
Yeah.
But Cosmic Thing went, you know, international. It went mainstream.
It sure did. And I have to think this probably helped a lot too. MTV played the videos nonstop, and
it was perfect timing.
Yeah. Man, I know it. And you were so perfect for that band. I know Charlie played on some of the record, right? Charlie Drayton was on some of the record. Yeah. But you, I remember seeing you in 1990 with the band, and it's like, you may as well have been the original drummer, really, with all due respect to Keith. Is the original drummer's name Keith?
Yeah. Keith Strickland.
Yeah. Keith Strickland. Yeah. Yeah. Who I always thought it was an underrated, really great, you know, had a great kind of vibe about him. I mean, he plays guitar now, right? In the band. Or,
yeah. Well, not anymore. He's actually not currently touring with the band. They've been using Greg Saran.
Ah, okay.
Who you might know from American Idol. And a couple of other guys, John Andrews, who I've worked with as well. But never with the Bees. When I did it, Keith was the guitar player. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But what was I going to say? You had just said that.
I just said that
seemed like a perfect fit.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was really lucky in that being my first really big gig, you know, that again, like you said, I was on MTV every day, and we did a world tour. You know, it was supposed to just be a 5-week tour initially, because no one had any idea the record was going to blow up like it did. And it ended up being 14 months and going all over the world. But I was lucky in that being my first gig, it was a band that I already loved.
Yeah.
I mean, like loved, you know, all through high school, that's what we danced to. That, you know, and the Police and the Rolling Stones and the new wave of the day. But especially Rock Lobster was the kind of thing where when that came on at a high school party, everybody danced, you know.
Yeah.
It's just so uninhibiting, that music. It's like it's deliberately silly. It kind of doesn't take itself too seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's got this cool factor that not much music had at the time. The whole like surf retro artsy thing was really brand new, which is why, you know, they weren't mainstream. They were at the cutting edge of what would be called alternative at the time. Like
yeah, yep.
That that term in music didn't even really, wasn't even really being used yet. They kind of helped them, the Talking Heads, helped make that category.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
But my brother had brought the record home in 1979, their first album. He came back from the Marines and he had that record and we played it and it was just like love at first listen. You know, it was so interesting, so original, so positive, mm-hmm. and just kind of infectious. And every song was just like, what? Wow. And so I loved the band. And so when I went to audition, it was not a stretch for me to get right into that headspace. And then add to that the fact that Charlie Drayton had recorded the album Cosmic Thing, along with Steve Ferrone.
Right.
Ferrone's on it. And Leroy Clouden and Sonny Emery are all on that record.
Oh, I didn't know Sonny was on it.
It was great drumming.
Yeah.
But Charlie in particular had already become a major influence on me. And so to get to play his drum parts on tour and in all the TV shows and everything, it was just like, it was like custom made for me, I felt like, you know,
because
it was exactly the direction I wanted to head in.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great, man. What a great way to put it too. I know Charlie's such an inspiration, man. He's just such a, talk about a positive, like just everything, you know, just
man. Yeah.
Soulful and his sound and, you know, like he's got all the bases covered and what he
does. Yeah. Cause a lot of people don't know, Charlie's history before, you know, the expensive winos and Neil Young and, you know, lately with Dylan, like he was this quintessential funk pocket drummer, you know, just very much in the kind of Harvey Mason, Steve Jordan vein. And that's what I used to see him play all the time. And so that was when he did the B's, it was a switch. It was like, okay, he's kind of like putting all those chops and that feel on the back burner and doing a more punk rock kind of approach, which, you know, at the time was very much in the air, you know, in the 80s. And so it was really interesting to see his approach to that kind of music. And I just totally got it. And that's the way I went about doing it too. Like, cause I had considered myself kind of a funk drummer as well, being that like my favorite band was Parliament Funkadelic growing up, among others, of course, but they were like, they loomed large in my horizon. And so seeing the way he played the B's 52 stuff, you know, like very minimal, which it already was. And he also played in a kind of minimalist style as well, but he just let go this really tight discipline he had when he would play the funk pocket. He let it get raw and kind of rough around the edges for the B's. And again, if you've grown up listening to rock, you know, you understand that. And so I just totally was like, I didn't even think about it. It was like,
yeah,
that's how you do that. And then I just kind of did it. And I was living in his parts, you know, touring all over the world, playing his parts all, you know, night after night. And I mean, as best I could. but it felt like it was just an easy fit for me.
So when you auditioned for the band, did it just feel really good to you at the time? Like, not that you'd be cocky about it, but I'm guessing because you were so comfortable, you probably didn't have what a lot of people have when they audition for a really big gig like that. You probably went in and just felt like, man, I can live this music. I know this music. I've been feeling it for 10 years now. And like,
totally.
Yeah. I'm guessing that bit of confidence helped you. Like, I'm sure they knew pretty quickly too, that you were the guy. Like, yeah, this is our guy.
Well, also the bass player who recorded that album was Sarah Lee. And she's actually the one who asked me to join because her band with Charlie Drayton and Steve Jordan, called the Raging Hormones, was working up to getting their record deal, mm-hmm. Which alas, they didn't get, but you know, they were pushing for that. And my band Body Bag was doing the same. And we used to play at the same club together. And that's how Sarah met me. And Sarah said, "Hey, you know, would you like to audition for the Bees?" So I had, you know, the comfort of knowing that the bass player was already, like, you know, in my corner.
Yeah.
And then, as I say, at that time, it wasn't like going into SIR with a major band, you know, having to like prove yourself. We were in a little studio in, where's that air? It's like around Chambers Street. You know, it's kind of like lower Soho.
Yeah.
It's below that. It's, I guess it's, I don't know, it's downtown, really downtown.
Yeah.
Not a glamorous studio at all. And, you know, again, they were just getting ready to do a tour, which they hadn't done in, I don't know, since probably 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And they were just really low key about the whole thing. You know, they didn't know what the record was going to do. So it was a total low pressure situation on top of everything, you know? Yeah. So yeah, I felt really comfortable. And I was kind of cocky, you know, I think.
Well, but I would say you were probably more confident, you know, just felt really like, yeah which is good. That's a great mug, by the way, like that bat signal.
Yeah.
But man, in that record, you know, I was just going to say, when you said it went on for 14 months, cause I remember it having, you know, great legs, great staying power with you had, Love Shack, of course, which was the lead single, and then Rome. And then there was there even another single after that too,
They put out another, they tried, but it didn't really take off. It was a deadbeat call.
Okay. But Love Shack and Rome were so huge. And, you know, I mean, you just heard, you saw those videos, like you said, in rotation, and you heard those songs on the radio. And big, big record. And so now, so you've established yourself at that point, really. You're the drummer in the B-52s at that point. And 1992 rolls around. And I'm going to just set this up because this is the story I remember. You calling me on a summer afternoon, and we'd been talking about you trying Zildjian sticks, and I was trying to get you to check them out because I was the drumstick guy in those days at Zildjian, in addition to the cymbal artist relations. And you've been playing these other sticks, and you said, I'd like to try them. And we were working out a deal, and you said, I'm going to go on tour with Bruce Springsteen. I'm going to be going on tour with Bruce Springsteen for a year. And I said, forget paying for him. I'll give him to you for free. But that was, I just remember you were so like low key about it. I couldn't believe it. I wanted to jump through the phone and hug you. You know, I was so happy for you, man. What a gig. So how did that happen? I know that, rest his soul, Jeff Beccaro had passed away. And I think he was offered the tour initially and declined.
Yeah.
And then.
Yeah. Yeah. He was offered the tour initially, but because he had done that album, Bruce said, you know, for our listeners who maybe are too young to remember, he had broken up the E Street Band.
Yeah. Yeah.
After like 20 years or something.
Right.
And he recorded an album with Jeff Beccaro. I think there might have been some other drummers on there as well, but Jeff did the Human Touch and the main tracks.
Gary Malibur did the other one. Yeah, Lucky Town.
Yeah, yeah.
Gary, yeah.
And he asked Jeff to go on tour at the end of the whole thing, but Toto was going to go out, so he couldn't do it. So that's when Bruce started to audition drummers. And it was like a big thing. He auditioned drummers for months. And I know he heard all kinds of guys. I mean, it was a cattle call for real. And I was lucky enough to be toward the end of that process. So I get a call from a girl named Debbie Gold. May she rest in peace. And she was tasked with the job of basically rounding up drummers for Bruce to Hear. And I think she got my name from Steve Jordan. And so she called me and she said, you know, Bruce is going to go on tour. She's looking for a drummer. Would you be interested? And at first I was kind of like, let me think about it. And then she said, this is going to change your life. And I was like, well, I knew who Bruce was, of course.
Yeah.
But I just hadn't really thought about it. And that's the cool thing about my job that I love is from the outside, everyone looks at the industry one way. You look at music, you look at musicians, you look at, you know, performances, everything one way. But when you're on the inside, it's a little different. You see a lot farther. Like with every artist I've worked for, it's when you work for them that you really get to see how vast their influence is. And you realize, oh, wow, he wrote that song for that other artist, like, you know, Fire for the Pointer Sisters.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
You know, and so she was right. You know, it just really changed my life in that it gave me a whole new stature above where I had just been with the Bees. And it was a different kind of music. So I was meeting different people. You know, you go to a Bruce party and it's just like, it's full of rock stars, you know?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
So yeah, it was, so I had to fly out to LA once she said, okay, you're going to do it. Right. And I was like, yes. Okay. And Bruce was very meticulous about the audition process. He actually didn't tell me after the first audition, flew me back home. Then I got a call from Debbie again. He wants you to fly back out. Did it, auditioned again with a different set of, musicians. Flew back home, still no word. This happened like 4 or 5 times before Bruce finally said, okay, this is going to be the band.
Man, I didn't know that, Zach. I knew you auditioned, obviously, and I guess I never got that story, you know, that, and how did you, I mean, did you look at it like you were busy enough doing other stuff? You probably looked at it like, man, I auditioned. If I don't get the gig, I'm in the B-52s. They're going to go out on tour again. And I'm going to, you know, and you were starting to get calls to do other stuff anyway, because the B-52s had taken you to another place too.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely was not sweating it. But as the process went on, you know how that starts to creep in, and you're like, okay, I think I actually really want this gig.
Yeah, I do.
And I
do.
I hope I get it. And by the end of it, yeah, I was just like, you know, chewing my nails. What's going on? And finally, Bruce was like, okay, this is it.
And I was like,
yes.
Man. And so when you approach that music, because, you know, I know that, I think you even told me this at the time, like he was looking for a different sounding band, obviously. I mean, you're a very different drummer than Max Weinberg, and the other players in the band were very different from what he was used to, and, you know, the other musicians. And did he pretty much let you be you? Did he just kind of just, because I know he's a taskmaster. I mean, he's known for being pretty.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely let me be me. But I think, again, it was something I could relate to pretty easily. I didn't try and play it. I was actually faithful to a lot of Max's parts because, you know, growing up hearing his music, the way that whole band created Bruce's sound, you don't want to, you know, stray too far from that. You know, a lot of those parts are integral to the song. They're not like fills that are intended to be showy. They're fills that only serve the song and sometimes become like a figure of the song, you know?
Yeah.
I think the most, you know, ambitious one to play as far as playing drum fills was probably Born in the USA, where, you know, you're almost soloing, you know, through the end of the song. But even that, I pretty much kept the flavor of where Max was coming from. And I have no problem with that, you know. In fact, it's funny because I meet a lot of musicians these days who, you know, the industry's changed. And on some gigs, you know, it might even be a big tour. But when that artist is not touring, these guys are in cover bands. And it's funny because in the era I came up, I never played in a cover band. You know, at that time in New York City, a lot of bands were just doing original material and getting gigs and playing in the clubs, Danceteria, CBGBs, Peppermint Lounge, wherever you were playing, people went out to see original music all the time. It wasn't like, I mean, you know, they still do. There are lots of singer-songwriters out there, you know, plying their wares. But it's funny how many guys it's not funny, but a lot of guys really have to do, they have to, even if they have a big gig, they're doing cover band on the side. And so in a way, playing Bruce's music, it was like being in a cover band because I'm playing songs that I used to hear on the radio.
Yeah.
But you're doing it with the artist. So it's not a cover band.
It's not. No, I was going to say, yeah, it's for real. That's cool, man. Yeah. I was lucky to see you two times on that tour because I saw you at the beginning of it. I remember the late summer of 92 in Worcester, the Worcester Centrum. Mm-hmm. Some people call it Worcester. And then at the
who said that?
No, I don't know. People from way far away see it spelled and pronounce it Worcester.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you played the old Boston Garden at the end of the year in December. I remember it snowed. I brought my sister. She still talks about it. It was like a snowy December night, but like a Sunday night, but we came out and saw you and it was, you know, it was like just an amazing, amazing show.
Well, Bruce is amazing.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely. Every time I've ever seen him, you know, I've seen him lots of times with Max too, but I just remember, you know, it was the hearing the songs played by you and the other musicians in the band really gave it like a different flavor, a really cool flavor. And then when the E Street Band got back together, it was kind of cool to hear it that way too. You know what I mean? I wouldn't say any one was better than the other, but I thought you brought like a really fresh energy. And I remember Max telling me, honestly, not long after that, when I met him and he's doing the Conan O'Brien show, I went to see him in New York and we went out and had a beer afterward. And he was talking about you and saying something to the effect of he didn't know that I knew you. And he said, if you get a chance or he said, I don't know if you had a chance to see him, but he's a really great groove drummer. He grooves better than I do or something like that, which was really big of Max to say that.
Max. Yeah.
He said that. He said, I'm not that kind of groove. I can't groove like that, but he's got like a serious pocket. So yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So kudos.
Thank you, Max.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I know that was a life-changing gig because, you know, that was the, you know, the biggest gig. Like
it was, and Bruce still plays big gigs, you know. Yeah. He's got some staying power like few others, you know. It's amazing. There's so many artists doing really big tours right now, but we'll see how many of them are doing that 30 years from now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you come off the road with Bruce and, you know, I'm just kind of going by sort of chronological order, 1993 or so. You end up on Billy Joel's River of Dreams record on a lot of the tracks.
Yeah.
And that, by my understanding, it was Danny Kortchmar that called you in, that he was producing it.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you know Danny or
No.
Was he familiar? So he just had heard you play and wanted you to come in and play on it.
Again. And I could be wrong here because I've never really confirmed it with him, but I feel like Danny might have said, Steve Jordan gave me your number.
Okay. Because Steve's on the record too, I know.
Steve came in because Steve couldn't do it for whatever reason, but he came in at the end and did a couple of one or two songs, I think. I'm not sure how many, but just like the finishing touches to the record, but he couldn't do the whole thing. And yeah, I didn't know Danny. I didn't know any of the musicians. Nico Bolas, the engineer. It was all a whole new camp. And I had known one guy from Billy's band, Jeff Jacobs, keyboard player. Because mm-hmm. Jeff Jacobs and I did a tour way back in 88 together for an artist, Grayson Hugh. That might have been when I met you.
Yeah.
So that was 1988. And Jeff was in the band, but he wasn't at the recording sessions. The recording sessions were me, the late, great T.M. Stevens.
Yeah.
Who we just lost.
I know. Wow.
And Danny and Billy. That was the rhythm section we tracked with. There were some dates that TM couldn't do, so I called in my friend Lonnie Hillier, who I grew up with, to come and play bass. And he's actually the bass, or at least one of the bassists on the title track.
Okay. Yeah. Was it in New York, Zach, or was it in LA?
Yeah, the Hit Factory.
Hit Factory, okay.
The newer Hit Factory, not the original one from the 60s, but they had a new location on West 54th Street or 53rd Street, I'm not sure, but yeah. Between like 10th and 11th Avenue, yeah. Near where SIR was. And it was like an over-the-top, gorgeous, no expense spared studio. It's beautiful.
So coming into that session, did you bring your own drums in, or do they have drums there for you? Like, were they using like a house kit for everybody to use, or?
Artie Smith.
Good old Artie. Yeah.
Good old Artie. He was there, and he had his, you know, vintage amps and vintage drums. This was back when the vintage thing hadn't really taken off yet. You know, people were still, you know, playing through digital stuff a lot.
Yeah.
And, but Artie had the collection. So if you wanted that sound, you went to Artie.
Yeah.
And he did all the big sessions. You know, and he was everybody's favorite tech. Steve Gadd.
Yeah.
Jordan. Everyone was using him. So that's how I met Artie. And that was really great. Such a funny guy.
He's a funny guy, character. I haven't spoken to him in a while, but
me neither.
He'd call up and, yeah, he, you know, he's a character, man. All, you know, he's worked like.
But isn't it interesting how at that time, I mean, now everybody has vintage everything.
Yeah.
And they have it in their home studio. At that time, there were no home studios. And few people had caught on to the vintage thing. One of the first people I really saw to hit me up to it was on the Bruce tour, Shane Fontaine, the guitar player.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, every guitar player in New York I knew at the time had big racks of digital gear. And Shane was playing a Gretsch hollow body, and he had stomp boxes in like drawers of a rack behind the stage. And I was like, wow, you're using that old stuff. And he's like, and that's why he got that gorgeous sound.
Man, what and a tone.
People were ahead of the curve, what can I say?
Yeah, you know, I didn't remember his name, but I remembered him, and I remembered his sound was like, my God, it was like otherworldly. He had such incredible tone. I mean, I always thought Bruce had great tone,
yeah,
and he does. But then, like, Shane was like, you know, a whole other level of just gorgeous tone. You know that like
yeah.
Say that,
and it was the perfect foil for Bruce's really like. Just like muscular telly sound.
Yeah.
And then you had Shane with all this beautiful ethereal, like warm, lush.
Yeah, exactly. Tones,
which, you know, now everyone's, you know, well-versed in, but at the time, only a couple of cats were really doing that.
Yeah. Do you stay in touch with him, or do you ever work with him?
Unfortunately, no. I've lost touch with Shane.
Yeah. Just wondering.
I saw him briefly after that tour. And then, like, yeah, we just kind of fell out of touch.
Yeah.
I hope he's still playing.
I'm sure he is, man. A guy like that, he better be. But back to Billy. So I made a note here because just knowing your relationship with Steve Jordan and how he's a hero of all of ours, you know, how cool was that, the first record you'd played on that you and Steve both played on together?
Yeah.
The first time. Yeah. That must've been, again, just a thrill to know that you're on that. And you were on about 5 or 6 tracks, I think, on that whole record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was it was a great experience because Billy was so cool. And then, you know, TM was just a riot and so warm and friendly. And his groove was amazing. It was like so easy to play with him because his groove was just so huge. And Danny was really cool too. You know, the vibe was very laid back. I learned later that they had actually been in the studio already, maybe for a week before I came in. I had no idea at the time. I thought, you know, day one for me was day one for everyone. Mm-hmm. But I think I learned, and it might have even been this year, 30 years later, 30 something years later, that he had already been in the studio trying to track these songs and was not happy with the result. And that's why, you know, I got called.
Yeah.
I had no idea about that because another friend of mine, Van Romaine.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I think TM was trying to get him on the record and had called him and said, listen, man, you might get a call because things are going, you know, not so well. And so Van told me that. And I was like, wow, I had no idea that they were in prior to, you know, like, you know, to me showing up.
Yeah.
But it was a great vibe. So when I got there, they weren't all tired out or, you know, at the end of their patience, it felt just really relaxed and we were just having fun. And every day was kind of, you know, we could do one song, we could do two songs. It wasn't like, you know, because Billy had a budget, obviously, and they weren't rushing things. So it felt really, really comfortable. And Artie was there setting stuff up for me. So I felt like I was getting this royal treatment. You know, for me, it's a new thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun.
I was going to say, if, you know, having been on all these big tours before that, you had like that side of it. Now you're like in a big budget session, which we both know those sessions kind of don't really exist anymore either, where there's, you know, a budget to come in and like work all day. And I was going to ask you, so were you hearing the songs for the first time when you went in the studio?
Yeah, we would hear it. We were doing everything day of. They didn't send me any music. So just go in and hear a song and try it. And the first tune we did was All About Soul. And it just sounded great. And so we were off to a good start. So that just made me feel confident that, you know, the whole record was going to be like that. I think it wasn't, you know, there were times when, looking back now, I was so green, you know, I really didn't know how to handle everything they threw at me. In my opinion, obviously they kept everything and put it on the record, but looking back now, God, I just, I didn't have, well, we didn't use a click.
I was going to ask you that. So no click.
None of that stuff is to click except for the title track, River of Dreams.
Yeah.
And, I just really was like, you know, just taking it all in and just doing my best. But I didn't have a lot of experience in the studio.
But, you know, I'll bet that worked to your advantage, Zach. I'll bet the fact that you didn't have any like preconceived notions and anything that was going to get in your head. And it's like you just went in there with like a clean slate or like a clean palette, and just that would be my take on it, is that you were able to go in and just kind of listen to the music and go, all right, I'm going to play this. And
yeah, you know what I mean? I guess so. If I were going to give advice to drummers today, I would say to do as much recording as possible, because there are things you're going to learn that you just can't learn until you record over and over and over and hear yourself back over and over and over and solve different issues that come up. You know, you just don't have the tools in your toolbox yet. So, you know, I think I brought something to it that was a kind of energy and a freshness, but I think I would have approached certain songs differently if had I done it today. And maybe the audience wouldn't like it so much, but I don't know. I just feel like I've learned a lot since then.
That's great. And so when you went in and did these songs on the record, did you a few takes, obviously. Were you able to, did you feel like you got a lot of these tunes in like one or two takes, like early takes, or?
Yeah.
I know it was a long time ago.
I mean, it was a long time ago, but I don't remember. If something wasn't working out, after two or three takes, we just moved to a different song.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, we're going to get this, you know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, cracking the whip. It wasn't like that at all. It was like, okay, let's keep it fresh, you know.
Yeah. And that was that more Danny Korchmar's kind of?
Yeah. Yeah. He was totally at the helm.
Yeah.
And, you know, Billy Joel was shotgun. He was riding shotgun, but he was letting Danny really, I think he put it in Danny's hands. Like,
Okay.
I tried it my way. Let's see your way.
That's great, man. Well, I'd like to play All About Soul.
Okay.
Speaking of that first song. And so here it comes. Zach Alford, Billy Joel, River of Dreams album. First song you recorded.
It's all about soul. It's all about faith and a deeper devotion. It's all about soul. 'Cause under love is a stronger emotion. She's got
love those strings.
She turns to me sometimes, and she asks me what I'm dreaming. Then I realize I must have gone a million miles away. Then I ask her how she knew to reach out for me at that moment. And she smiles because it's understood. There are no words to say. It's all about soul. It's all about knowing what someone is feeling. The woman's got soul. The power of love and the power of healing. This life isn't fair. It's gonna get dark, it's gonna get cold. You gotta get tough, but that ain't enough. It's all about It's all about soul. It's all about joy that comes out of sorrow. It's all about soul. Who's standing now? Who's standing tomorrow? You got to be hard, as hard as the rock in that old rock and roll. That's all it.
Man,
I singing his butt off.
What a great, yeah. You know, I had Liberty DeVito on a couple of years ago on my podcast, and I said to him, and this reminded me, like, he's such an underrated singer, I think, Billy. You know, he's, I don't know that he really gets enough accolades and acknowledgement for how great a, you know, he's a phenomenal piano player, obviously, but what a great singer. So much,
yeah.
So much soul, you know, and it truly, like, and I, you know, here are my quick takeaways. And I remember this song. I didn't remember the title, but once I listened to it and you mentioned it, I'm like, oh, I love this song. And the last 2 minutes, the way it builds.
Yeah, you know, we just had that. It's that chemistry in the studio when something feels right and everyone looks around. They go, yeah. And this, you know, Nico Bolas, the engineer, he's got a thing where he dances. When he feels like it's the take, he starts dancing. And so, you know, we'd be playing, and if it, we thought, okay, and we look over at Nico and he'd be in there, you know.
That's like, a good sign. Yeah. And that's TM on that track playing bass.
Yeah.
Oh man, he sounds so good. You both sound so great together.
Recommend headphones if you're listening, because it'd be a shame to miss the stuff he's doing.
It's beautiful. And man, you know, your commitment to playing the groove is so deep. You know, there were so many opportunities for like a hot shot to play a fill, but you chose to just ride it out and just keep that groove going. You know, there were like a couple of spots where you played maybe like a little eighth note thing, really an accent, but you just, you committed to just making it feel so good all the way through. Masterful.
Yeah, I think that's why, you know, my career was as successful as it was, because I really believe in playing for the song. You know, I love flash too, but when it's called for, not feeling obligated to do it all the time. And that's just the school of drumming I came from, listening to guys like Steve Ferroni and J.R. Robinson and Jerome Braley from Parliament. You know, Steve Gadd, John Bonham, you know, guys who groove was what drives it. And you know, watching Charlie play growing up, the first time I saw him, I was 15. And he was 15. And he was playing like a grown-up. It was the first time I'd seen a kid who could play like that. And he was just so restrained and disciplined, but so tight. I didn't even really get it at the time. I was still too new, young to really understand. But I knew, like, wow, that's cool. And that's when I started to really buy into the whole less is more, because Charlie could play nothing. I mean, he had this thing, people who would see him with Hiram Bullock will remember, where people are taking solos, right? They're all amazing musicians on stage. And then would come time for Charlie's solo. And Hiram would look at him like, go ahead. And he would just play that pocket. Just play the pocket and make it even deeper. And if he did a fill, it would be like one tom place you didn't expect, and just be so funky. And the thing that would always, you know, the thought I always had was, I can do that. Or like, I could do that, but why didn't I think of doing it?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, Charlie, it's the stuff he thought of, you know, the choices. And so for me, it always became like, choose wisely. And so that's the way I approached everything. And as a result, I never really became a great improvisational drummer. But you know, I had a different thing, you know, trying to be a guy like, you know, Jim Keltner or you know, guys who just would get the call because they would make the song feel great.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you got something. Don't worry. And I think it's great what you said too, because I think all of us, when we're young drummers, are guilty of what you're talking about. Like the idea of like, there's a little bit of space there. You know, it's just asking me to play Little Phil, a little something cool, you know, that girl in the front row is going to dig. And, but Charlie, you know, God bless him, man. At that young age, he kind of understood. He was, you know, he came from a musical family, and he just had that maturity at a young age to kind of know to pick his moments, which you do now. And I was just going to say, I'll bet you, I don't know Danny Korchmar, but I think I know enough about him that your approach, I think, was exactly what he was looking for. And the way that you showed your restraint on those songs, played to the integrity of the song. And that's so important.
I try to.
Yeah. So now the next thing I know, Zach, you're telling me you're going on tour with David Bowie. And I'm like, holy, are you kidding me? Because I'm thinking you'll never get a bigger gig than Bruce Springsteen. So don't get too full of yourself. And then you end up playing with Bowie for a long time. I mean, that was like, I'm like a bunch of years and then a little bit of a break. And then, but how did it come about that you ended up playing with David Bowie?
Again, just like everything in my career, it's pretty much been word of mouth. So, or a recommendation from a good friend. Bowie had a drummer named Sterling Campbell.
Oh, of course.
Now, Sterling and I went to junior high school together.
Yeah.
So, you know, and he went to high school with Charlie Drake. So it's like this New York family. And he recorded on Black Tie White Noise. That was his first venture with David. But they never really toured that album. They did, you know, a couple TV shows. And then that was it. And then a few years later, David wanted to embark on a different kind of project and go back to his really experimental roots. And they recorded the Outside album, which they did in Switzerland. And they did it in this new approach that, again, you know, people were starting to do more editing, more pro tooling, you know, looking at recording more as like a kind of pastiche. And so David was really interested in that. So they recorded it really quickly. They did a lot of post-production. But at the same time, David was getting very into painting. Sterling told me that sometimes he would just have a canvas set up in the studio and he wouldn't even be singing. He'd just be painting while the guys were working on music.
Wow.
Anyway, after the recording of that record, he kind of went down this painter rabbit hole. And Sterling didn't hear from him for like the rest of that year. He didn't hear from him from the next year. And then the next year, Soul Asylum approached Sterling and said, you know, do you want to not just tour with us, but we're going to sign you on as a member of the band.
I remember that. Yeah, he was a band member. Yeah.
And, you know, David wasn't doing anything. And guys like us, you know, we have to take opportunity, you know, we got to make hay when the sun is shining. So he joined that band. And right after he joined the band, David calls him in 1995 and says, okay, I'm ready to go on tour. And Sterling was like, I can't do it.
Oh.
So David said, oh, you're kidding. You know, well, I don't want to audition anybody. Just tell me who to use. Just get them. And so Sterling called me and said, I happen to be actually recording up in Woodstock at Bearsville Studio. And he said, are you busy in August? Which was like next month. And I said, no. And he goes, do you want to play with David Bowie?
And you said, let me think about it.
Yeah. Let me think about it. Yes. And he sent me a cassette tape of the new record. And so while I was tracking one record at Bearsville Studio, in between takes, I would put on the cassette, put on the headphones, go into the room and learn the whole album in between takes of this other project I was doing. And then, you know, it just came time to show up to New York and I showed up and, you know, David wasn't there. We just rehearsed the rhythm section, which at the time, Mike Garson hadn't done a Bowie tour since the 70s. And I think the last tour that Carlos Alomar had done was probably Spider Tour, Glass Spider.
Oh, wow.
Because he didn't do the Sound and Vision tour. That was Adrian Ballou. And Gail Landorsi was brand new. I was brand new. And Reeves had never toured with Bowie as a Bowie tour. He'd done Tin Machine.
Yeah, yes.
As a band member. But he'd never done a Bowie tour. So it was an interesting dynamic between all of us. But then we rehearsed for a week and things came together. And then David came in and it was just like, hi, everybody. And we had moved it into SIR by that time. So we had the full soundstage. And we just rehearsed for another, I don't know, 3 weeks or something. And that was that.
Yeah. And that was a couple.
And again, this is music. A lot of it I'd grown up with. A lot of it I didn't know. Because I wasn't like a you know, rabid Bowie fan. So I knew Ziggy. I knew Let's Dance. I knew Station to Station. Actually, Station to Station was my favorite Bowie record at the time. Mm. I knew Lodger. I knew, obviously, the song Heroes. I knew the song Gene Genie. I knew like the stuff that everybody knew. But I hadn't listened to Hunky Dory. I hadn't really listened to The Man Who Sold the World. There was a lot I didn't know. I didn't know Diamond Dogs that well. I didn't know, you know, doing that tour, I learned a lot of the songs. Same with Bruce. You know, I had to learn all these Bruce songs I never knew. It's a lot of fun when you work with different artists. You know, I often think about guys who were famous in bands. And, you know, it's easy to be jealous of the recognition they get as a band member, you know, whereas I'm just a sideman. But what I love about being a sideman is, you know, these guys have to play the same songs decade after decade. I get to change my repertoire and, you know, have a new,
yeah,
you know, a new, just a whole new world, basically, yeah. to explore and inhabit each time. And so you grow as a musician, you widen your horizon. And since you're touring, you really live the music. It's not like just being a studio musician where you're playing all this music, but, you know, the day after you record the song, you never play it again.
You know? Right. Yeah. No, that's true. You're right. I remember when you had that gig with, I saw you at least once, maybe two times with David Bowie. And again, just, you know, you brought like your thing to it, which was so cool. And you seemed so comfortable with it. Like it was a gig that was, you'd been doing for a long time, you know, that you kind of had just stepped
into. Well, once again, you know, I got the opportunity to play with a hero of mine, you know?
Yeah.
Which is not always the case. Very often, in fact, probably most of the time, people have to take gigs that they're not that into, or that, you know, maybe they don't even really know the artist at all, or maybe they even don't like it, but they have to do it because they need a gig. I mean, to get to play with someone that's like a legend, it's just, you know, I pinch myself. Years later, it was like, did I really do that? You know? And so how could you not be comfortable in that situation? You know, it's like you're getting to play music that has so much meaning to you and to so many other people in the world. And so, you know, before I said I might have been a little cocky, here it is, the same decade. I'm going, you know, for all these amazing, you know, these like huge gigs. I mean, I like to think of myself as a humble person, but looking back on it now, I think I was kind of cocky. Not necessarily outwardly to people, but I thought, you know, I thought I'd made it. Yeah. And you think, that's it. I've arrived and this is where I'm supposed to be. And, you know, it's not until the decades wear on and things don't always go so well that you realize, maybe I haven't made it. Maybe I have to keep making it all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And I think for people on the outside who don't know your everyday, daily, you know, day-to-day life, they think, you know, you're just living the dream. Mm-hmm. And you are. But part of that dream is waking up and waiting for the phone to ring because that artist decided, just like with Sterling, you know, Bowie took a few years off and he had to go pound the pavement, you know. And basically, I've not had a decade like the 90s since. I mean, I've managed to stay in the game and I've had a couple of, you know, juicy ones. But that was a special decade for me.
Yeah, yeah. And let's face it, the business has changed a lot too since then too, and that's
evolution, you know.
Yeah,
things change. You can't fight it.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's great what you said though, Zach. I think that's important for listeners to understand that, you know, and when you're a working musician, you've always got to be. I hate to use the word hustling, but like you say, you can't ever assume that the phone's always going to ring. And everybody I know in your position that I've ever talked to has said the same thing, that like, it's, you know, you've got to do the right things, which you do, which is be on time and, you know, be a good guy to hang out with on the tour bus and all that other stuff. But it's not just that. And you've got to be a great player, which you are, but you've got to hope that the stars align, like you say, that when you get that phone call from David Bowie, that you're not already committed to something else and you can take a big tour. And I say this because I've talked to guys like yourself that had committed to something and it's like, it's a good thing that they want to do. And then a giant thing comes their way and they got to go, oh man, I'm already doing this. Kind of like Sterling with Soul Asylum,
what happened to me after. I was in Japan when David called in 1998 to do VH1 Storytellers. It came out of the blue because I had asked him, is it okay if I go to Japan and do this tour with Hotei Tomoyasu?
Yes. Yeah.
And he said, yeah, sure. I got nothing to hold you back. Have fun. And then literally like, you know, a week after I arrived in Japan, I get the call, oh, can you do VH1 Storytellers? And I said, you know, not only have I signed the contract and I'm already here, but I'm just, you know, I felt so committed to Hotei, you know, that I couldn't, I'd already done one tour with him. And so actually, I'm sorry, this was 1999. And I just thought, you know, I can't just leave.
Right.
We're about to go on tour, you know? And that's when Sterling came back.
Yeah. 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 No, that's tough, man. That's, I mean, it's, yeah.
And I worked so much with Hotei over the next 5 years that I actually turned a lot of gigs down because of that.
Yeah. But you know what? You have a reputation for honoring your commitments, and I that goes a long way. You know, that goes a long way. I think for everybody that I know that's ever done that, it ends up working out in the end, you know. It ends up sort of coming out in the wash, as they say. But then in the 2000s, you toured with Gwen Stefani, right? You did a couple of, yeah. And that was that, did she had like a solo record, obviously, or maybe a couple of records.
Yeah, she no doubt had basically broken up.
Yeah.
Let me back up. Maybe they hadn't broken up, but they were on a hiatus and she decided, oh, I'm going to do my solo record. Thinking, you know, whatever, it's just going to be fun. It'll be a tribute to all the stuff that she loved in the 80s and 90s. And it just blew up. You know, it blew up. And so, again, for her, the same way like Love Shack took the Bees to a new level, her solo career brought her to a whole new level. And she was like, I think she was the first artist to ever get a million. I don't know if it was YouTube or iTunes, but whatever on. I think it was iTunes, a million downloads.
Wow.
She was the first artist to get a million downloads on iTunes. So it was mega. It was massive.
Yeah.
And again, I got called because she wanted Gaylan Dorsey on bass. That was the one thing she knew. She wanted to use a couple people that she knew from No Doubt, like Gabe and Steven on trombone and keyboards and percussion. And she used Warren Fitzgerald from Orange County. He was in a band called the Vandals.
Of course, yeah.
Sorry, not the Vandals. Vandals. Yeah, the Vandals.
I think, yeah, that sounds
and,
right.
Yeah, and then she got this new guy, Chris Pooley, who was the music director. And she asked Gail, I don't have a drummer picked out, but you can, whoever you want to play with, that's who we'll use. And Gail called me, and that's how I got called into that.
That's great, man. Wow. I want to just jump back. There's a question from Malcolm Moore that I want to just...
Malcolm, hey, what's up, Malcolm?
Yeah, he's watching, and it's a good question. He's saying, Zach, how challenging was it to take the studio tracks you did for Earthling and arrange them to play live with David Bowie?
I would say it wasn't that challenging. Because for Earthling, they were my tracks for the most part.
Yeah.
There was one song, though, called The Last Thing You Should Do, which it was me, but Mark Plotty had done a lot of post-production cutting and editing and manipulating to the track to create the song. And when I heard it and we had to play it, I only remember playing it once, and that was on the birthday show, David Bowie's 50th birthday. Mm. And I just thought, it doesn't sound like me playing. It's not the way I would play necessarily. I mean, it's probably some of my fills, but they're moved and put in a different spot or, you know, used. I'm not sure how he did it even. But But when it came time to do that, I just had this epiphany, and it was literally like the day of the show. And I just thought, I'm going to open up and do some, you know, just let myself go on it. And it ended up working out, luckily. But that was kind of challenging. The other challenge, I think, was just learning how to groove with loops, because it's the first time I toured playing to tracks. I had to learn really how to play to tracks and to click on the Bowie tour. I didn't do it that with Bruce, didn't do it with the B-52s. Mm-hmm. And so that was the challenge. And that, you know, you start out by putting the click loud in your mix, and over time you can back it off. But at first you just really need to hear it, because once you hit that stage, your adrenaline is pumping.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't know whether your mix is going to be right. Every room is different. You know, there's so many factors that you just make sure that that click is really loud and you can hear it. Over time, and when I say time, I mean like months. It takes a while to really, I mean, obviously people liked the shows. A lot of the, you know, I can watch a lot of those videos and not cringe. They were good. But I know that my click playing developed over time to where it just naturally gets better. You can't make it get better. You can do your best to get better at it.
Yeah.
But it's almost like it has to happen. It has, something in you has to change to where you finally, it's like, you know, in the Matrix, when Neo finally at the end can see everything. Yes. It's like, it just happens when it happens. You don't necessarily control it. And so I think I got better and better at playing to a click from that tour, but it took a while.
But
because there's before you can play with a click, and then there's, you know, playing with a click where you think you can play with a click and you kind of can, but then there's after you can play with a click when suddenly you're just not even thinking about it anymore.
Yeah.
And you realize, like, oh, you look back, like, all this ground you've covered, and it happened almost without you noticing it.
Yeah. That's a really cool perspective. I appreciate you being here today, and I just want to talk about, you've been playing with the Psychedelic Furs for the past 2 or 3 years now.
Yeah.
I think sort of before COVID and then post COVID.
Well, just before COVID, we talked about touring and started to plan the dates. Then COVID hit and we hadn't even rehearsed yet.
We
basically pushed everything back a year. So we didn't go out till the end of 2021.
Right. And that's kind of your gig these days, right? I mean, you're still working.
Yes, we're going to be going to Australia next month.
Oh, great.
For 2 weeks. And then we come back and we go via Hawaii. We'll stop off there, do a show or two. Then we're going to hit the West Coast and come down the West Coast and a little bit into the Southwest.
Fantastic. That's great. So that'll take you into the summer, probably.
Yes, that'll take me to the summer, which I'm not doing really much there. And then we pick it up again in the fall.
Great. Congratulations on an amazing career. What a career. Still going, too.
Thanks, John. And it's so good to catch up, man. It's been years.
I know, buddy. I know.
Now that you're a retiree.
Yeah. This is my encore career right here. So.
One day I'll have a drum room like yours.
All right. One day I'll be able to play like you, maybe. All right. Well, Zach, hang with me for 1 second, and we'll end the stream and say goodbye to everybody. Big hand for Zach Alford, and I'll see you all soon, everybody. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's my show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, give it a like, leave me a comment. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't done that already. And the podcast is available on all the podcast platforms. So download it. And remember, no drummers are ever harmed on Live From My Drum Room or Track Talk. And drummers, when in doubt, leave it out. All right. Again, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And I'll see you again real soon. See ya.